Yes.
Where's James today?
James is ill.
Sick. Yes. James is ill.
Yes, I meant to mention that earlier. And so also...
What's he got?
He's got the lurgy, yeah.
The list of people to pray for this afternoon to be mindful of.
There are a lot of people.
Goes on. All right. I'm in the... in the series on the parables of Yeshua. And as I mentioned the other day, I'm hoping that the series that I'm doing at the moment, the parables and also the week where I concentrate on kingdom authority, I hope it's not too alarming to people, because getting into human nature and talking about the dynamics of human nature can be depressing. But unless we realise what we are made of, unless we know what makes Lesar and Gosling tick, what makes Owen Fisher tick, what makes Laurel Moon tick, unless we know that essential self within, unless we can really identify the pros and the cons in relation to it, how on earth can you overcome?
Hey.
How can you? You've got to know yourself. And this is what all the mystics of the ancient world used to say, well, even the modern world, know thyself. But we don't know ourselves, largely. But anyway, I promise in this lecture that I will not resort to any rap music. shucks, yes, I know. But I would like to mention right at the start of this lecture, which I've entitled The Parable of the Talents, How Do People Behave in the Absence of the Master? All right, somebody's smiling over there. Because, you see, we tend to have the attitude of when the cat is away, the mice do play. And of course, that's a revelation of the nature of man. We tend to let down. When our teacher walks out the when we were growing up, our teacher would walk out the classroom and say, "Everybody, make sure you keep still and don't talk and study this paper while I'm away." And soon she'd walk out, chat, 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 chat. Or aeroplanes flying, paper aeroplanes, or somebody getting thumped, or somebody copping it with an orange. Yeah, what do you call that?
Spitballs.
But this is what the parable is about, essentially. So, the section I'm dealing with is in Matthew 25. But before I get there, who was Matthew Levi? He was a man, of course, who wrote the document we know as the Gospel of Matthew. And he was an individual who was called at the toll booth. Now, it's rather interesting. It is through Matthew... Sorry?
You got that
one? No, I got that one wrong. Thank you. He was called at the toll booth. So his interest is finance. And you'll find through the Gospel, he's the one who records the payment of the temple tax. Yeshua getting very annoyed with Simon Peter and saying, whether or not I pay the temple tax is no business of the authorities. You know, he was very circumspect about his life and grabbed hold of Peter and he barred him from coming through the door, if you remember. He was angry with Simon Peter about the taxation issue. And he says, "All right, if you want to pay the temple tax, go down on the beach and you'll find a fish. Open its mouth, you'll find the coin. There'll be enough in there for you and me." Rather interesting. But again, it's the man who was called at the toll booth who records that incident about the coin. And also in Matthew 18, we have a parable about an individual who was in debt for millions of dollars in today's financial lingo. And he also has a whole section in Matthew 25, which we're going to look at today, which is about investments and financial shrewdness. So Matthew is the one who is geared for this kind of info because of his background. That's his talent. That's his ability. So let's turn to it. Matthew chapter 25, beginning in verse 14. And I'm going to sort of modernize this a little bit from the point of view, instead of referring to the word master or slave master, I will use employer, and instead of slave, I will use employee, so that we put it in our modern language. The rest of it will stay as it is. Verse 14, For it is as a businessman who is about to depart to travel, who called his employees and distributed his possessions to them, with the responsibility of caring for and managing them. To one he gave a sum of money, 5 talents, and to another a sum of money, 2 talents, and to another a sum of money, 1 talent. Now, a talent was worth about 15 years of a labourer's wages. That's how big a deal this is. So to each person, according to his natural ability, and immediately went away out of the country. And he that had received the 5 talents went immediately and traded in them and made a profit of 5 other talents. In like manner, also he that had received the 2, he also made a profit of 2 others. But he that had received the 1 talent went and dug in the earth and hid the money of his employer. And after a long time, the employer of those employees comes and settles up accounts with them. And he that had received the 5 talents came to him and brought 5 other talents, saying, Sir, you delivered me 5 talents. See, I have made a profit of 5 other talents. His employer said to him, Great job! You good and faithful employee, you were faithful over a few things. I will advance you into a position where you will rule over many. Enter into the joy of your employer. And he also that had received the 2 talents came to him and said, Sir, you delivered me 2 talents. Behold, I have made a profit of 2 other talents besides them. His employer said to him, Great job! Good and faithful employee, you were faithful over a few things. I will make you a ruler over many things. Enter you into the joy of your employer. And he also that had received that 1 talent, coming to him, said, Sir, I knew from my experience with you that you are a hard man by nature, reaping where you did not sow, and gathering from where you had not winnowed, and being afraid, I went away and hid your talent in the earth. See, you still have that which belongs to you. And his employer responded by saying to him, Pernicious and slothful employee, you knew that I have a habit of reaping where I have not planted, and I gather from where I have not winnowed. You ought then to have deposited my money at least with the bankers, and when I return, I should have got what is mine with interest. Take therefore the talent from him. Give it to him that has the 10 talents. For to every one that has shall be given, and he shall be in abundance. But from him that has nothing, that even which he has shall be taken from him. And cast that good for nothing employee into the outer darkness, that which is outside. There in that place shall be weeping and gnashing of the teeth.
Mash.
That is a heavy parable. A very heavy parable. And there are all sorts of interpretations about this parable in Christian circles. A whole lot of them. And one of the most popular that I've come across speaks of the present absence of the Messiah, which of course it is about, no doubt about that. And that human beings should be accomplishing in his work here below. So I've got no argument with commentators who concentrate on that. But the positioning of this parable in Matthew is rather interesting. In Matthew, it is located in the midst of a section which deals with the eschatological teachings of Yeshua. That's end of the age teachings. He mentions just before this parable, he mentions the 5 mature bridesmaids and the 5 spiritually immature bridesmaids and the subsequent judgment of the nations at his return. If you look at verse 14 of Matthew 25, because you're in Matthew 25, Matthew mentions a journey being taken. Notice a man traveling into a far country. And in verse 19 of the same chapter, you find a reference to Yeshua's return. It says, he will intend to return after a long time. Well, you're not kidding. That's that's 2,000 years at the moment. All right, so that's quite a journey, and it's a quite a long time. And but Mark is interesting because Mark has a parallel account. If you hop over to Mark 13 and have a look at verse 34. Now, you're wondering why I'm not saying in Matthew. We need to compare the parallel accounts. They are most important, and for reasons that I will include in a second. But he speaks in verse 34 of Mark 13 of a man going on a far journey who left his house and gave authority to his slaves, to every man his work. Now, notice, therefore, be constantly alert and on the watch, for you do not know when the master of the house comes, whether at evening time or at midnight or at cock crowing or in the morning, lest having come unexpectedly, he finds you inattentive, at ease, falling asleep. All right? And clearly, there's a warning message in that parable in Mark's gospel, because he has this very chilling summation of it all. He says in verse 37, and that which I am saying to you, that is to you disciples, Yeshua says, I am saying to everyone. So this is the Lord's love for the world. He's saying, listen, I'm not just speaking to you. He said, I'm speaking to everyone. Be constantly watchful and alert. People around the world are beginning to realize even now something's happening in the world. Something is happening. I speak to people even next door. They're happy, healthy pagans. But I tell you what, this week he said, the world's gone crazy. He said, what's happening? And I wanted to say to him, well, it's coming to an end. But I don't want to yet turn him off, because he's becoming interested very slowly, because we've known each other now for some years. And we've never pushed our religion down his throat. And he's never, ever inquired, because he's such a happy, healthy Anzac. And we don't want to upset the apple cart. And it's interesting, as soon as you bring politics or religion or sex into something, woohoo! It's division, tension, and all that. Okay, now in Luke, we find the same parable. If you turn over to Luke chapter 19, you find the same parable with a slight shift in details. And it's placed between the story of Zacchaeus, who has to climb a tree because he's too small. Although, interestingly enough, it doesn't say who's too small. We all assume it's Zacchaeus, but it doesn't say that. It could have been Yeshua who's too small, and therefore surrounded by people he couldn't be seen. All right. So he sticks the story in there, and also between that and Yeshua's triumphal entry into Jerusalem. So Luke has the Lord Yeshua portray himself in an interesting way. Look at verse 12, because Yeshua portrays himself as a certain man of noble blood and social position. That's the Greek. Noble blood and social position. Fit for a kingly throne. You know, Yeshua didn't have any doubts about his self-awareness. He had no doubt. And he could speak with humility and say that that's what he was. Who went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. But look at verse 14. I find this interesting. His fellow citizens hated him and sent after him an accredited governmental representative. That's the Greek. Sent after him an accredited governmental representative, saying, we do not want this man to reign as king over us. And isn't that what Israel has been saying now for 2,000 years? Yeah. We don't want this man to reign over us. I remember a rabbi saying to me, even if Jesus is the king of the Jews, I will never bow my knees to that man. Oh.
Ooh, wow.
You know what? He's one day going to learn what it is to have his shoes filled with you-know-what. That's a fact. And I think he will kneel. I think he will kneel.
He's seen him through different eyes, though.
Well, he's seen him through the eyes of the world's churches and what they did to Israel. I understand that. I understand that.
So he can't bow to that figure because that's not the Messiah. That's a...
very naughty boy.
Yes.
What? All right. Unger's Bible Handbook says this about Matthew's parable. In the parable of the talents, the man travelling in a far country represents Christ during his absence from the earth. He entrusted gifts to his servants, which are Israel, during the tribulation. The 5 and 2 talent servants are believers who enter into the joy of the Lord, that is, the kingdom blessing. The 1 talent servant, a mere professor, is excluded from the kingdom in outer darkness and swept away in judgment with the ungodly. Now, it's rather interesting that Christians today teach that believers can lose their salvation based upon this parable, and Unger appears to believe that as well as believing in the rapture and so forth. Incidentally, I will be giving the rapture I will be giving the world a glimpse of the rapture in the next 5 minute segment that we're doing for the YouTube filming. All right, and I'll be quite honest about it because I would like to believe in the rapture, and I'm going to approach it that way. I'm going to ask people out there, look, tell me, please, show me where it is. I want to believe it. I don't want to die in the Great Tribulation. Only a fool would want to martyr himself. I want to know how to escape it. But in the hundreds of books I've read on the subject, the thousands of documents that have crossed my path, all purporting to believe in the rapture, proving the rapture, I've yet to be convinced it's not there. And I've got reasons why it's not there, and I want to discuss this with the public and ask them to use their little brain power to enlighten me. So I think that should be an interesting approach.
It's become another point of division within the Christian church, though, because if you don't believe it, then you don't have God's Spirit to enlighten you into the fact. So instead of saying, well, if you're a believer, you'll be whisked away with the rest of us, they say, if you don't believe in it, you'll be left behind. And that's heinous.
Well, that's just pure fear, portion, isn't
it? Of course.
And the thing is this, that it's growing all the time in numbers. They're all on there again. Yeah, and years and years ago.
It's just sick. Society now. Yeah, everybody wants to escape everything. Yeah. Nobody wants accountability for anything. They don't want to stand up and be counted
but
for anything.
But the government will fix that.
Pass the buck.
And I'll just be here. And
the government does the same thing too.
Yeah, the same thing. It's just on and on.
But even apart from the rapture, even apart from that, the very doctrine that we can lose our salvation, you know, because we fail to measure up to God's expectations of us, all right, hear me, we fail to measure up to God's expectations of us as we express ourselves in our daily walk in overcoming in the Christian life, that whole approach needs to be re-evaluated. But, of course, they fall back on this parable. So what I want to do today is to talk about the parable and see what it actually says and see what it doesn't say. That's the point. But you know what? Faith, love and hope all join hands. They link hands together. And then they jump out the window. But it's true. They jump out the window because they are replaced by anxiety, depression, and even in some cases, insanity and suicide. That's fact. That's fact. Now, I have been mentioning in the previous lectures on the parables that we need to go back to the Second Temple period. We've got to forget about the Protestant Revolution of 400 years ago. We've got to forget about it. Go, because these documents were not written in the days of the Protestant Reformation. All right? They were written way back in the Second Temple period. To properly understand the parable, you have to go back to that time period. Duh, of course you do. Because that's when Yeshua gave it. That's when Yeshua trod the earth and all of that. So, what we need to have a look at is the fact that in all the parables that he shared, the Messiah's undertone at all times was toward encouragement for living your life with piety, doing the right thing by your fellow man and woman, showing your love toward God. To have your focus on heaven's expectations of you. That was what he was doing with people. He would share with the disciples, but he would share poignantly hard, cold facts with the disciples, but he would use parables with the crowds. I've explained all this before. Because he wanted to take his precious time to enable people to inculcate an attitude of being able to be, well, to be enabled, in order to become ennobled. All right? This is something to remember. When we walked through the door of the AOG many years ago and joined in ministry with the AOG, we were looked upon by the pastor at the time as nobility that walked through the doors. That's his words, not mine. And I was taken by that because apart from all the spiritual riffraff that had come in and out of his organization, we, Glynis and I, represented something noble. Because even though we were going through trials, we never talked about them. Even though we were going through poverty, that didn't come up. Even though he knew about us. Even though we were going through the strain and struggle of human existence and some shocking trials at the time, we were still able to give to people. And he just sat back going, wow. He said, we know that your family's converted. He said, I've got 300 other families in this church. And he said, I don't think any of them are converted. And I did a spin out on that. Okay? Interesting, isn't it? Interesting. You know, Yeshua combined apocalyptic thinking with practical living. And that's what you find all the way through his parables. An emphasis on the end of the age, but more of an emphasis on how to live. That's what he was doing all the time. And, Yeshua came at a time when the people expected a Messiah to appear. They expected a human being to appear. They did not view, back in the Second Temple period, that the nation of Israel was the Messiah, not the majority at least. A minority of people believed that Israel was the Son of God and as such the Messiah. But all the people of whom we have record in the Second Temple period expected a human being to appear as the Messiah. This is denied today in the synagogues of the world. But the people also knew that Daniel the prophet had said in Daniel 9 verse 26 that when the Messiah came, he would suddenly disappear and vanish from their midst. Most versions have be cut off. He would be cut off. But according to the chronological conception of the Persian period in Daniel 9 from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, appearing in the Journal of Ancient Judaism, volume 2, 2011, page 293, Professor Michael Siegel recognizes that the Hebrew should be that he will disappear and vanish. And did Yeshua disappear and vanish? Yes, he did. One minute, he's there. Next minute, he's gone. He's crucified. He's raised from the dead. He appears on the Mount of Olives and takes off like Superman, jumps into the sky, and that's the end. That's the last you see of him. And the disciples are there with their mouths on their chests going, did you see that? Not even a goodbye. He said, boom, gone. And angels had to come and say, you men of Galilee, why are you standing gazing into the heavens? This same Yeshua who you've seen taken into the heavens shall so come in like manner as you've seen him go. And Zechariah tells us that his feet, the feet of Hashem, the feet of Yahweh, if you wish, will stand in that day of crisis around Jerusalem. He will stand on the Mount of Olives. Yes, a human being will stand on the Mount of Olives. I've covered this whole business about God's Son coming in human form in my Isaiah lectures and in my lectures on Daniel in the past. But it is interesting that the Talmud tells us that the rabbis pour scorn on the idea that a human being would come as the Messiah. But I would answer them by saying that Rabbi Akiva, not only expected the Messiah to be the thought forms of God, but he also expected that the Messiah would be a human being because he anointed Bar Kokhba as a Messiah, as the Messiah of Israel. So the argument of the rabbis that it was only going to be the nation of Israel that would be the ultimate Messiah of God is nonsense, absolute nonsense. They've got a lot of explaining to do in their rejection of the idea that Messiah was to be expected personally rather than the mere nationally. All right. I want you now to turn over to Luke 19 because it's most important to grasp the recognition of the parallel account.
They will have to change their tune on that, though, won't they?
Well, they'll have to very soon.
I mean, way before Yeshua comes back.
Absolutely. Because if the Messiah is going to...
It has to be a false Messiah. Mimicking of
well, it's got to be a mimic.
Yeah.
Yes, one of those. If you go to Luke 19 and have a look.
Probably the Antichrist by farmer.
If I was in this world system, I'd vote for him. Anyway, let's have a look at this. Luke 19, verse 11. When they heard these things, he added and spoke a parable because he was near to Jerusalem. And because they thought the kingdom of God should immediately appear. And he said, therefore, a certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. And he called his 10 servants and delivered them 10 pounds and said unto them, be busily occupied in my business until I return. But his citizens hated him and sent a message after him, saying, we will not have this man to reign over us. And it came to pass that when he was returned, having received the kingdom, he commanded these servants to be called unto him to whom he had given the money, that he might know how much every man had gained by trading. The first came, saying, Lord, your pound has gained 10 pounds. And he said, well, you good servant, because you have been faithful in a very little, have thou authority over 10 cities. Now see, he's adapting the parable to the people who are listening to him, those in the seat of the parable. It's the same parable, but he's just changing a few things. And the second came and said, Lord, your pound has gained 5 pounds. And he said to him, well, be over 5 cities. And another came saying, Lord, here's your pound. I laid it up in a napkin. For I feared you because you are an austere man. You take up that which you didn't lay down and you reap what you didn't sow. And he said to him, out of your own mouth will I judge you, you wicked servant. You knew that I was an austere man, taking up what I didn't lay down and reaping what I didn't sow. Yes, you see, he's God. God can do anything he wants. That's what makes God God. Wherefore, I remember many years ago, somebody in this very class said to me, but God can only keep his own law.
Duh.
I went, what? I said, the law is for us, not for God.
Somebody wanted to sound profound or something, did they?
Oh, he said, well, I suppose he can do anything as long as it's his will.
You're still running in the same circle?
Okay. Wherefore, then, did you not give my money to the bank, that at my coming I might have required my own with interest? He said to them that stood by, take from him the pound and give it to him that has 10 pounds. And they said to him, Lord, he's already got 10 pounds. I say unto you that everyone who has, it shall be given, and from him that has not, even that which he has shall be taken away from him. But those my enemies who would not that I should reign over them, bring here and slay them before me. And the Greek says, cut their throats from ear to ear. So, this is Yeshua, the gentle Lord, meek and mild. Now, but you notice the contrast here between Matthew and Luke. It's the same parable, but he's adapted, Luke's adapted his parable to a different milieu. Now, having said that, what happens to the enemy, the one who hates him, the one that doesn't want to deposit the money? Well, in Matthew, he's cast into outer darkness. But what happens here in Luke? He's has his throat cut. So, hello, there's obviously a tension here between the two. And notice, too, they will not have... They're not brothers and sisters of Christ. These are people who will not have Yeshua rule over them.
Mm.
He won't. They won't. So they are clearly, whoever these people are, they are clearly devoid of God's spirit. They're devoid of it. They're tares. They have to be. And notice in Matthew, Yeshua condemns his failed employee to outer darkness. The reason, as we will find as we go through this parable, is because he's already living in inner darkness. Now, remember what I've been telling you over the last few weeks about the erotic instinct on the one hand within human nature, and on the other hand, you've got the death instinct. You've got one which leads to life and one which is not happy until destruction is evident. The only comfort that man would have would be out of darkness, even though he wails and has gnashing of teeth, because the death instinct reveals itself in chronic failure. Psychiatrists all know this. The death instinct will find ways of creatively manifesting itself in failure. In fact, rather intriguingly, Menninger, the psychiatrist, has this to say about human nature. Now, you may not understand some of this. You may understand it. The only reason I'm quoting out of here is because I've got all the other psychiatric books out there in the garage in boxes, but this one is on my shelf. He says, unendurable thwartings, you know what that means. It means thwarted self-will, you know. Unendurable thwartings lead to unendurable resentment, which, lacking the opportunity of a justification, or the proper psychological setup for external expression, is repressed, directed inward, absorbed for a time by the administration of the ego, but with the ultimate result of an overtaxing of its powers of assimilation. In other words, the erotic instinct and the death instinct are in conflict to such an extent that they can't be properly absorbed and assimilated as they should be. He says, this is an elaborate way of saying that unmastered self-destructive impulses, notice, lack of control, unmastered self-destructive impulses, insufficiently directed to the outside world or insufficiently gratified by external opportunities, are reflected upon the inner self. In some instances, appearing in this form of constantly maintained anxiety, which, in the end, produces the very result which had been anticipated and feared, but wanted, namely, annihilation. That's a fact. That's the degree to which human nature will convince itself, through its continued thwarting of self-will, but that's what it deserves, and that's what, of course, it ends up getting.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what it gets. Mm. And that's just showing a psychiatrist's point of view on that. You know, there was a psychiatrist who lived many years ago. His name was Solomon. He said, as a man thinks in his heart, it's in his unconscious, so is he. So is he. He can't be any other way. Okay. Where am I? Yes, getting back to Luke's...
Potsville.
Thanks very much. It's really the same parable as given in Matthew, but adapted to Luke's audience, all right? And that's a Judeo-Christian or Gentile audience that Luke's writing to, whereas Matthew is writing to Jews and to Jewish Christians. It is rather interesting. Just after the birth of Yeshua, I'll just throw this in as an aside. Up here on the whiteboard, you've got the parallel account in Luke 19. And Yeshua bases it on events still fresh in Jewish memory. Because Herod the Great, just before he died, Herod the Great went ahead and placed at the entrance of the temple of God, over the entrance of it, a huge golden Edomite eagle. Right? You don't do things like that in first century Judea. But Herod sticks it up on there, or in the Second Temple period, I should say. And and there was a huge uproar, and that uproar left thousands of Jews massacred. But eventually, some very, very God-fearing Jews got up there, and with axes they hacked it off, got rid of it. And in the meantime, Herod croaks it. He dies. But in his will, he leaves the empire, the Judean empire, to his son by a Samaritan woman, Archelaus. And Archelaus takes the place of Herod. And but at that time of Archelaus ruling over Jerusalem and Judea, there are martyrdoms galore occurring because he's not a nice man, all right? And people are saying, we don't want this man. And he's leaving Jews dead, pell-mell, and dying all over the place, martyrdoms everywhere. And he ends up going to Rome to get Caesar Augustus to confirm that he is now king instead of his father Herod, because Herod's dead. So he goes off, and uprisings occur in Jerusalem while he's away. So he sends a whole lot of troops back to Jerusalem with envoys of peace, trying to settle the whole disturbance so that Caesar will realize, you know, he's really in control. This man's in control. So the Jews stone the Roman soldiers and those envoys of peace. Now, Rome could have declared war, but they didn't. They bent over backwards to satisfy Jewish demands. But Archelaus comes back and he slaughters thousands of Jews in the streets. So the embassy of Israel, the Sanhedrin, send a whole lot of Samaritans and Jews, Jewish authorities, this is where they linked hands, the Samaritans and the Jews, back to Rome, sent them back to Rome, saying to Caesar, quote, we will not have this man to reign over us. Now, it's rather interesting. Yeshua has taken the events of that period, applied them to his own life, so that the listeners all could identify with what is going on. And when you know the background to this parable in a physical way, it makes it rather interesting. It makes it rather exciting to read about it. Josephus wrote a heck of a lot about it in his Antiquities and also in his Wars of the Jews. And it's a period of time we need to give more attention to. But in Yeshua's parables, it is stressed that one ought to be busily engaged in the urgency of activity before it is too late to do so. As Yeshua said in Luke 12:48, to whom much is given, much is required. People say, wow, I want to have all that you know, all the knowledge you've got, Gosling. You're a walking encyclopedia when it comes to theology and the biblical revelation. That may be the case or it may not be the case. But the only way you're going to get there is to qualify as I did. Take time out to read and to study and to inculcate what you read and you study. Is it easy? No. See these grey hairs? They're there for not just because of kids, they are there because of all the effort that I've put in over the years. But you have to also get to the point where you realise the heavy hand of God in your life. Because that's what keeps you in check. That's what keeps you from going the easy road.
Which isn't an easy road.
It keeps you from going the easy road.
That you think
it is. Which you think it is. That's right. But to whom much is given, much is expected, much is required. All right. None of us can afford the luxury of a negative thought. You can't. You can't expect it. Negative thoughts lead us into futility and faithless disregard to the especial needs of others. Positive thoughts, intimately coupling with a generally negative personality disposition, make strange and uncomfortable bedfellows. They just do. But we have to make a start somewhere. Obtaining an education concerning human nature and the strategies of our inner opponent is the only place to start. There's no point in saying, I have kingdom authority, I'm going to exercise kingdom authority, if you haven't looked at your own nature and exercise kingdom authority over that first. Now, there are a number of points I want to bring out about this parable. Point number one. I want to point out that which is patently obvious to anyone reading this account in Matthew. Right? It's a heavy parable, straight from the lips of the one in whom is to be found grace, unlimited mercy, and unconditional love. Bear that in mind as you read that parable. Because I don't find much grace in there, I don't find any mercy in there, and I certainly don't find unconditional love in there. The guy didn't measure up, so he gets cast into outer darkness and all, and the other account he gets his throat slit. Point number two. The parable has to be considered in its context. It leads from the previous parable in Matthew about the bridesmaids and the second coming of the Messiah. And in fact, the parable starts off with the word for. If you read very carefully, it starts for blah, 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 blah. In other words, it follows on from what has gone previously. That's got to be kept in its context. Number three, it is the single most distressing story from the mouth of Yeshua when it comes to its use as far as sectarian control over the lives of sincere people who only wish to find real meaning, true meaning, for their lives in service to God. That's a fact. Because people will use that parable to exercise control over others. If you don't measure up, you're out. And if you're out, you've lost eternal life. Your baptism is invalid. You know, you've been given the royal order of the boot. It's awful. But they do this. At point four, the character of the slothful employee, because some people feel sorry for him. Having said that, his character is one of fear, apprehension, even terror of God. There is no genuine affection at all for God from that person in that parable. And when we examine that person in question, we are confronted not by maturity, but by an inadequacy of a sort where he is not even capable of taking risks for his employer. He won't even risk anything because he is afraid of failure. As I pointed out in Man Against Himself, that quote a few minutes ago. He's afraid of failure, which means he will dig a hole for himself, not just for the talent. All right? That's a fact. So, is there any need for authentic believers to shiver in their boots or to quake in their high heels when it comes to this portrait of such a harsh and demanding Messiah? That's the question. That's the question.
It seems even more harsh and demanding if he would take one of his own and do that if he didn't live up to their
absolutely
expectations.
Well, that's what people read in
that's
the parable.
Like kids reinforcing Zeus concept.
Always, always. But this is why I keep saying we've got to get away from the Protestant Reformation interpretation and go back to the Second Temple period. Let me say this about Yeshua. My experience of him is that he's no fool. He is not a sad sack. He is not to be treated with any sense of disdain. He was never a damp tea towel, nor was he a limp dish rag. This was not evident during his ministry, and he is not this way now. And I think there are some Christians who altogether want to disparage any idea of the masculine nature of the Messiah. They want to reduce him into an effeminate individual who has no right to exercise any sense of justice here below, especially amongst his own brothers and sisters. That's what we've done to Yeshua. He's worshipped as the lamb by people, but they don't want the lion side of his personality. They don't want it. They distance him from that. And especially is this the case amongst some people who have become universalists in their disposition. And I single them out. I mean, I am a universalist, but I still see the lion and the lamb in nice balance. Even in material we feel we can trust, there sometimes lurks an element of deception as writers attempt to distance God's righteous justice from an all-out enchantment with his grace. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this is because I was extremely disappointed, to say the least, with Dennis, Matthew and Sheila Fabricant Lynn, who are the authors of Good Goats, Healing Our Image of God. And I mention this book in this context because I've recommended it to people and to others in the wider, broader Christian community as a wonderful source of a better understanding of the grace of God. And I stand by my assessment of it. It's a great book. I love it.
God's love.
God's love flows through it. But having said this, I always read a book that I like two or three or four times. And on the second reading, I go to the acknowledgements, I go to the bibliography, I go to the source material, I go to the index, I look at the whole book to find out who said what, why, and how, and when. And a short time after my second reading of Good Goats, I did my usual checking of source material, always my custom, because I've got a habitual discipline, because a lot can be gained from such a perspective and procedure. And this is where my disappointment with the authors came in, because on page 59 there is a quotation from someone called James Birchall. And if you've got that book, have a look at page 59. Speaking of Catholic procedures, he says that confession has sometimes, quote, been turned into something reminiscent of a tribunal. The priest sitting in judgment on the failures of the penitent and assigning a token penalty. He says this is a grotesque confusion because it embodies precisely what Christians believe God does not do. A judge can never forgive. A judge can only condemn or acquit. The one thing Jesus can never do on the Father's behalf is punish. The dynamics, and he is correct on that, because Yeshua doesn't punish his people, he corrects them. Big difference.
Yeah.
Punishment is punitive. And he goes on, the dynamics of a criminal court are perhaps least apt to serve as a suggestion of what God is trying to do to us by his forgiveness. Unquote. Now there's the quote. So I had a look at the bibliography. No mention. So I thought, well, maybe under resources for further growth, there might be some reading material mentioned there. Nope. No mention of the source for the quotation, except that it came from someone called James Birchall. So I Googled James Birchall. Bingo! Ha-ha! A homosexual priest linked to national priest abuse scandal, suspected pedophile activity, student gay solicitation, disgraced, debarred and jettisoned from Notre Dame University back in 1991. This man, as usual with these people, was an anti-gay crusader, opposing all calls of acceptance of homosexuals in the community, against all legislation of homosexual activity between consenting adults. So apart from his crimes, he was also a blatant liar and a hypocrite. The book Good Goats was written in 1994. This man was disbarred and jettisoned out of Notre Dame in 1991. Okay, hear where I'm going with this. The Lynns, the authors, knew quite well that this ex-priest had been defrocked and disgraced way back in 1991, yet they felt justified in giving him a prominent place in their book as if to add prestige and theological relevance to it by including his quote. I would have distanced myself completely from this fellow. No matter how good the quote was, surely there must have been a priest of good standing they could have quoted from on this issue. All right? And this is what I don't like. It's a disappointment to uncover this horrible tactic in an otherwise quite exemplary little volume.
Perhaps they were reinforcing their own position.
Well, maybe they were reinforcing their own position. I don't even want to go there. We should all be, though, on constant alert. We should all be on constant alert when it comes to engaging in discipleship and taking steps to become better educated in the things that really matter. Again, I have nothing against the book. It's a wonderful book, and I will read it now a sixth time. I absolutely love it. It's full of fabulous concepts and dimensions of reality. Sir?
Very easy to read.
Easy to read book. But, back to the parable. This is about money. It is not about our innate gifts. It is not about our talents, even though we've taken that word talent from the concept of money and said we have certain abilities and gifts and talents. It's not what the parable's about. Go back and look at it in the Second Temple period context. It's not about our gifts that God gave us at birth or whatever. It's an item of coinage. Further, the one who is cast into outer darkness in the Gospel of Matthew is one who has zero character traits of love or of God's Holy Spirit. He is denominated purely by fear and anxiety. See, the bottom line is you believe in, you become like the God you believe in. And clearly his view of God, the Rebbetzin said before, is more like Zeus than God. Your theology dictates the way you perceive life to be and is demonstrated in your conduct the way you believe you should be. This disengaged employee concentrates only on God's ruthless side, one might assess, of the Ten Sephirot. He sees God as a God of severe judgment, not of kindness, not of compassion in his theological view. It is his theological and biblical misunderstanding that has helped to create in him his hatred of God. Now, you may not read that in there. You may not see, I hate you, God. But that's what his whole persona indicates. Yes?
Don't even a large majority of Christians see God as the God of judgment?
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
They do.
And a large majority of them. They live a very unhappy life.
And therefore, if they see God, the majority of them, as a God of negative judgment, not positive judgment, but negative judgment, then I question how long it will be before God actually opens their heart to grace.
Yeah, that's right.
And some of this takes ages.
The thing is, it's not untrue. It's another one of those true statements that, because he is a God of judgment, he does judge down to the marrow, but it's the overemphasis of it.
It's the overemphasis. Again, it's like taking the tense of fear up. They're taking the tense of fear up, and there's on one side you've got judgment and whatever, on the other side you've got mercy, and you're going over here instead of embracing the whole thing. Embracing the whole thing. But this fellow, you've got to read between the lines. Yes.
It's righteous judgment.
Well, righteous judgment. If you want to take the word judgment and use the term that was used amongst the Jews, justice.
Justice,
The justice of God is rooted in his grace.
Yeah.
This is the fact. And in fact, justice in the Jewish concept is equal to salvation. The Latin form of justice is, you did that to me, I'm going to do that to you. I'm going to get back at you. I'm going to destroy you. That's justice. Well, that's Latin, not Jewish thought. Justice means salvation in Jewish thought, which is interesting. Now, having said that, this man does not love God, even though he wants to please him. This is the perversity of human nature. He has no idea of the divine nature. And let me say this, nobody born of God hates God the Father, Mother. Nobody born of God hates God. We are not only saved by grace, but we are saved for grace. Don't forget that. It's over in Ephesians chapter 2. Have a look at this. I'm going to finish in a second. Have a look at Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 8. It says, "For by grace are you saved through faith. And that faith, not of yourselves, it is the gift of God." Look in verse 10. "We are his workmanship, created in Messiah Yeshua, to perform good works, which God has before ordained that we should walk in them. Therefore, we are saved by grace and for the purpose of grace." Whatever God's wanting is what he's going to get. But our salvation is not based on our works, either good works or bad works, but on that which the Messiah has achieved for us and imputed to us. In any event.
Nothing to do with it.
Sorry?
We had nothing to do.
Nothing to do with it. So in any event, the awards we receive at the dais of Messiah will never affect our destiny. Even if our works burn up, we shall be saved, even though it be through that fire. And you can read 1 Corinthians chapter 13 on that one, chapter 3 on that one, verses 13 through to 15. Now, I've talked about the negative view of this employee, but let's have a closer look, because I've written a number of points down you may not have actually seen. But next time you read this parable through, consider these points. Number one, he is an altogether ungrateful individual. Look at verse 18, chapter 25. He is an altogether ungrateful individual. He stands before his employer, and rather than ask forgiveness, and here is, this is even worse than being ungrateful. Look at what he does. Instead of asking for forgiveness, instead of saying, "I'm sorry, my employer, I'm very sorry." No, instead of doing that, he insults him to his face. The one who pays his wages.
That was a very bright word.
Awesome insubordination. He insults him. Verse 24. Look at it. He insults him. Point two. He is guilty of erroneous reasoning. He doesn't see the employer as he really is. Same verses. Verse 18 and verse 24. Point three, he is himself unjust. He is the very thing of which he accuses his employer. In verse 18. You see, those little verses tell you a lot about this man. If I'd have been the employer and he had worked for me, and I had people working for me over many, many years, I tell you what, I would have sacked him on the spot. I wouldn't have thought twice. Intriguingly, psychologically, he has degraded the image of his employer in the mirror of his own evil conscience in order to justify his own conduct. That's what a psychiatrist would say. And point four, he is an habitual fault finder. He only sees the negative as well. Look at verse 24, same story. The same verse, he specialises in self-justification. The picture I'm getting of this bloke is not really a on-the-ball employee. He sees himself as entirely justified in burying the talent in the soil and then accuses the employer of being himself unjust, for he demands where he has not given.
He fired on, didn't he?
Oh, mate.
What a numb.
But here he actually has given, take what is yours. It does beg a belief, but these are the things. I know I'm pointing the obvious out, but the obvious is sometimes not even looked at. We read the parable, we miss all this. Point six, he is inwardly a fearful individual afflicted with timidity. Verse 25. Afflicted with timidity. And such people are often, as any psychiatrist knows, sometimes because they tend to be on the timid side, they're very catty and they're malicious, using their mouths to spit spite almost in a feminist way.
Yeah.
With venomous bitchiness. The Reverton and I know some people, I won't mention them, that they're locals. And they are catty people. And they can't say a nice thing about Glenys or a nice thing about me, but they want us to be their friends. And we're going, go away. Point seven. This fellow is called wicked. And the Greek for this is the sum total of one having an evil conscience. Interesting. Remember I said, you know, Jiminy Cricket, let always let your conscience be your guide. Careful on that one.
Another time, another place, I'm afraid.
Point eight. Often overlooked is his proclivity for sheer laziness. In fact, is this the reason the employer... When I read this through again, I thought, why did the employer actually give him only one talent? Why did he give one 10, one 5, and this one he got one? I had to ask. Well, yeah, you're right, You're absolutely correct.
God knows your heart, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, this employer knew this fellow was going to be a dead weight to his business. He'd already witnessed in his company settings his servants' repugnance to effort and responsibility. In any event, by burying the talent, he proceeds to live life as a good-for-nothing. Now, this is not stated, but it is implied because he cannot pursue his employer's business activities because he's already buried the means for his further productive service. Okay? When you stop and think about that, you go, oh, I tell you what, any wonder you're sure calling wicked. And point nine, he is terror-stricken at the thought of the return of his employer. He fears the worst, which is why he didn't want to lose the money or to unwisely invest it in the first place. But the believer, the true brother and sister of Yeshua, the true child of God, is looking for the return of the Lord with eagerness. I mean, I want to see him explode out of the heavens now. I'm ready. But no, we're going to have to wait a while until this happens and that happens and something else happens, and that's a pain in the backside. I really want to see the return of the Lord, because I'm not afraid of not measuring up. I'm not afraid of saying, oh no, I have got this problem and that problem and I haven't done this over here and I've neglected that and I've ignored him and I've upset her. None of that counts. It counts morally, but not in a salvation sense. It doesn't matter. He knows Yeshua has done everything in the final analysis for him, for the true believer. But with all my emphasis on the parables lately, there is a surprise. There is a surprise. If you haven't realized it yet, the surprise is that despite the negative characterization of the wicked employee, all these colleagues, the three of them, all of them, had a right attitude, hear me now, had a right attitude toward their boss in that they all desired to please him. All right? Now there's evidence of grace. There's a chink in the armour, if you will. The employee who buried the cash did so to please his employer because he didn't want to risk the money.
Yeah.
So even there's something that can be... what's the word? Salvaged. That he possessed a current of underlying issues that conflicted with his view of the boss can't be doubted or overlooked. But on the one hand, he wanted to do the right thing, but his motive for doing so showed his total lack of faith. He didn't have any faith. He was unable to take risks with his master's cash, so he was dogged, as Benninger said, by a constant fear of failure. He was far too reticent to take risks with another's capital, in particular that belonging to his boss. Yet he was able to go out and expend a heck of a lot of energy digging the hole to bury it. Considering all that I've covered in this analysis of the parable, would it be right and a good judgment for God, as the employer, to use this evidential circumstance of failure to measure up to his high expectations, to cast the unprofitable employee into outer darkness, as in the case of Matthew, or to have his throat cut from ear to ear, as in the case of the parable in Luke? You reckon it's a bit tough? So do I. And you know what? Everybody listening to the parable would have thought it a bit tough as well. Again, we've got to distance it. We've got to distance this. We've got to jettison any idea of this coming out of the Reformation in Germany or in England or in France or anywhere else where it occurred. Remember, the original parable of the Messiah had nothing to do, absolutely zero to do, with our innate abilities and gifts of expertise. It was all around money. It was all about business activity. And rather intriguingly, everyone listening to this parable, as they stood around Yeshua, as he shared it with them, realized he was using a Semitism. A Semitism. We all know what a Semitism is, don't we? It's an exaggeration to illustrate the force of that which is being shared. The birds of the air nest in the shrub that has grown from the smallest of seeds, the mustard seed. Number one, the mustard seed is not the smallest of seeds. Number two, it doesn't grow into a tree as Yeshua said it did.
No, it's a shrub.
It's a shrub. And if the birds of the air came and settled in it, they would destroy it and crush it, but not according to the parable Yeshua gave. That's a Semitism. You might say, oh, that's a lie. No, it's not. It's a creative employment of a means to get a point across. So they all knew that no employee would be cast into outer darkness for failing to turn a profit. No employee would have his throat cut from ear to ear. If anything, the slave master would sell him off to someone else. So they would have all stood around when Yeshua said this was going to happen. They would have all started to smile because they would have seen right through what he was saying. Yeshua saw this parable as a way to encourage his listeners and his own students to realize that had the employee or the slave a clearer understanding of the attributes of his master, he would no doubt have had sufficient vision to use his talent wisely. Remember too, this is a parable. And the last thing we should do is take a parable too literally. Yeshua knew it.
Don't make doctrine out of
parables. That's right. And so many people do make doctrines out of parables.
Of course.
And we shouldn't do it. It's a story.
Don't make a probable out of a parable. That, you end up with a problem.
You would, yeah, I like that.
You hear that again?
Blah, 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 blah.
Remember, the bottom line in this teaching is expressed in the words of the Second Temple rabbinic authorities. To everyone who has, the more will be given. That was the dictum of the rabbis in the Second Temple period. And the teaching was very simple. The Torah was given freely, all right? And it must be studied freely and expressed in positive terms toward others freely. That was the rabbinic view. And this accords with the saying of Yeshua, freely you have received, freely give. That's what he said. And the person who studies deeply will be given even more than he could possibly imagine. The more one learns, the more life he is given.
It's to make you think.
Absolutely.
And that parable, if you really think about it, why he got into trouble was that he was living in fear instead of, living in hope.
That's right.
And because he lived in fear of the judgment that was going to come upon him.
Mm.
He didn't realise that the God that says that flee from the devil brings fear, and if you flee from him, you'll get your victory, and he didn't
bring in
the positive.
That's right.
Yeah.
Martin Luther, priests hated it when it was his turn to go into the confessional. The priests used to pay each other off to listen to Martin Luther rather than have to go through 6 hours of confession. And one case, Luther took 13 hours in one sitting to pour out his confession to the poor priest who was almost going insane. And if there had been a gun, he would have shot himself back then. Luther.
Strange, Bob.
The more one learns, the more life he is given. Yet I had a person who comes here or came here turn around and say, I've just learned, there's nothing, there's nothing, you know, I'm trying to keep up with things, but there's nothing that, and I said, when was the last time you went on the board? I've already checked, I know how long it's been. I said, it's been a year and a half. You have not accessed anything on the forum. It's there. It's there to use. It's there to grow through. The more life you are given, the more abundance of life you will possess and experience. You know how I know that? Because it's a law of psychology. It's also a business principle. It is usually those who have much who are open to receive even more. Why? Because their attitude's wrong.
Yeah.
And it comes as he or she anticipated. It is a law of the universe. Yeshua articulated it perfectly when he said in John 10, verse 10, I have come that they might have life and have that life more abundantly. You see, God is extremely lavish with his love and his gifts. In fact, I'd even go one step further and say God is absolutely wasteful when it comes to his love. God wastes his love. Baruch Hashem. Thank God. Look at nature and you will see God in action. God is lavish in everything he supplies. So take another glance at the rejected employee through that perspective. It was his intention to preserve capital that ushered in his ruin. Think about it. Mm-hmm. It was his desire, storing up the barn. It ushered in his ruin. So if we take a deep breath and reflect with a refreshing air and flair of positivity on this parable, as given by the synoptists, even with their varying degrees of difference in the way they presented their parable of Yeshua, one can see that Yeshua's accent is not so much on the final judgment at his second advent, but on the application of divine justice and the present necessity of building character. Even so, while the weakness of character is vividly demonstrated in the so-called wicked employee, the parable is really all about God and his character. That's what Yeshua is emphasizing. This is a perspective universally missed when it comes to biblical commentaries on this parable of the talent. Yeshua's stress is on his students developing and inculcating principles of personal discipleship as it pertains to stewardship, as well as in showing a proper respect toward those who hold authority. It's clear that this parable also expects us to express our responsive love for God the Father and toward humanity in helping out others wherever we are able and whenever we are able to do so. Only by constant loving activities involving moral action and righteous living will we be enabled to be dutifully ready and prepared for the second coming of Christ. Only that, nothing more. Okay, any questions on that lecture? Praise God. Time for the love feast.